All right, we're on the air. Harold Pollack, welcome to the Glenn Show. It's odd me saying that on this occasion since you actually are in control of the recording device.
I am.
I always relished that prerogative, and now I've had to surrender it because of technology. We won't go into the details. In any case, Harold Pollack, University of Chicago School of Social Service Administration. You hold a chair there, Harold.
I do. I am the Helen Ross Professor of Social Service Administration, and I, among other various boring administrative titles.
Where's the boring administrative meetings and the boring administrative memoranda? Titles themselves are not so bad.
That's right. And what's your title?
I am the Merton P. Stoltz Professor of the Social Sciences and Professor of Economics and Faculty Fellow at the Watson Institute here at Brown University. So I'm overburdened with titles as well.
Yeah, we should really charge people just to talk to us, given all these titles.
I do every chance I get, Harold. I just don't get that many chances.
So before anybody hangs up on us, what's our agenda
exactly
for the day?
We're talking about ourselves. What are we talking about? So we're talking about race and police violence the character of the public debate these days, the Black Lives Matter movement, the blockbuster bestseller recently published by Ta-Nehisi Coates, his second memoir by the age of 40. That's noteworthy in and of itself. This book is at the top of the charts, and everybody's reading it and talking about it between the world and me.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about that. And actually, if you don't mind, Harold, I'd like to just take a moment before we even get started to issue an apology and a correction of the record. The apology is to Ta-Nehisi Coates. I want to make the apology public because when I discussed his book briefly with John McWhorter a few weeks ago, I made some comments about it that based upon a very superficial engagement with the book and that were inaccurate. I took out of context a passage in the book where Coates describes an encounter that he has on the streets of Baltimore and some thoughts that were in his head after that encounter about things that might have happened going forward, going and getting a gun and going back and confronting the person and whatnot. And he was using it in the full context as a step along the way of illustrating how deleterious, how damaging the environment of violence and fear that he remembers from his childhood had been even to himself. And he was putting it forward as a negative example, not as something that he would do, and certainly not putting it before his son, which I commented on as something that he'd recommend to his son. He wasn't bragging, which I suggested that he might have been doing. He was warning. I didn't understand that until I encountered his book fully. And so I misrepresented his book here, and that's not what I want to be doing at the Glenn Show or any place else for that matter. So thanks for letting me get that in.
No, it's. I'm sure that Ta-Nehisi will appreciate that, and a lot of what his book is actually about is about the way that his experience of youth violence, his fear of it, his experience of being a victim of it, how it has left scars in him, and how he's trying so hard not to inflict on his own son some of the scars and some of the hardness that experience put in him. And I found that to be quite a poignant aspect of his book. And it was both sad and hopeful. I think what was sad about it was his description of the many ways that that this violence had left a mark on him, but also how his self-reflectiveness about it has allowed him to, in his relationship with his own son, to not replicate that same hardness that he actually was raised on. And I think one of the aspects of that book that deserves more attention is the way that he has moved away from the use of physical discipline as a way to protect his child from the dangers of the world and the temptations of the world. And I think that's a conversation that really needs to be had. You know, I there was a video that went viral after the Baltimore rioting, where a woman basically starts, you know, basically slapping around her son because she's catching him doing some, I forget whether he was looting or he was misbehaving during the unrest in Baltimore. And
he was out on the street. I think the police had declared a curfew or made some other request that people leave. She wanted him to not be hanging out.
Yeah.
And she catches him on the streets and she's smacking him upside the head. What'd I tell you? Get your butt on home, et cetera, et cetera. And then somebody caught that on camera.
And there was something I found, you know, if the way to protect kids from delinquency is to impose that kind of discipline, our juvenile detention center would be empty right now, because that's the kind of discipline that a lot of these kids are already getting. And that's not, and I think we have to have a conversation about other ways that, I totally get why parents feel they have to do that. But I think that it's disturbing to me that, the public reception of that disturbed me. And I can't imagine if there were a video of me doing that to my own child, just on the streets of Flossmoor, Illinois, I just cannot imagine that I'd get 50, you know, a million YouTube likes or whatever, you know.
I think, though, some of those likes were not so much celebrating corporal punishment. They weren't, you know, necessarily congratulating this mother for hitting her kid, as they were just acknowledging how important thought that mothers take responsibility for the behavior of their children,
yeah,
are actively engaged in trying to dissuade their children from patterns of behavior that are self-limiting and debilitating. So here was a mother who loved her kid enough to get out in the streets and discipline him. Now, the fact that she was using physical violence to discipline him is going to be disapproved of in many quarters. We could have a talk about corporal punishment. I don't have a position, frankly, one way or the other. Maybe there are cultural differences, Southern versus Northern, or Black versus White. I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised to learn that such differences exist.
Yeah.
And I don't know the evidence, perhaps you do, about the extent to which there is a cause-effect linkage between, I'm not talking about severe abuse, you know, I'm not talking about someone who puts a cigarette out on their kid's hand or something.
Of course, yeah.
But between, you know, giving a spanking or whatever the equivalent of a spanking would be to a 16-year-old, on the one hand, versus, you know, telling them it's time out, go to the corner, or some other non-physical disciplining method, what evidence might exist to link any of that to future outcomes? I just don't know. I'm not taking position one way or the other.
Yeah.
But I must say that when I saw that mother doing what she was doing on that video, I was a little cheered by it, too. I was cheering her on, only because I wish more mothers and fathers, and I wish that there had been more fathers present, were, you know, enough aware of and enough concerned about what's happening in their kids' life to try to head off, you know, bad outcome. Don't hang out with these guys who are selling dope or, you know, dealing in guns or whatever. Don't think that, you know, being popular because you can swagger is a way of really getting ahead, like, you know, something like that.
No, I agree with that. The love is there, the attention is there, the passion and commitment is there, and I admire that. But I think that the method is both the method and the reaction of onlookers who often would not see themselves reacting in the same way concerned me. I see, you know, so much of the work that we do in Chicago and just walking around the city and watching the way parents interact with kids on the bus and whatnot. There's a lot of a lot of young moms who are stressed out, who don't have a lot of help from other adults, and whose method to try to elicit compliance and good behavior from their kids is a little over reliant on corporal punishment, I think is a concern. But I think the broader point that I wanted to bring out that I found moving in the book was the way that he was thinking through his own, the reflexes that he had developed because of his own need to be self-protective, growing up in a pretty tough neighborhood, and the way that he was self-reflective about it enough to think through how he wanted to be a little different in the way that he was relating to his son compared to the way that his parents had related to him. And there's one thing, if I could just take a moment, where he just said, "We're entering our last years together, and I wish I had been softer with you. Your mother had to teach me how to love you, how to kiss you, and tell you I love you every night. And even now, it doesn't feel like a wholly natural act so much as it feels like a ritual. And it's because I'm wounded. It's because I'm tied to the old ways, which I learned in a hard house, It was a loving house, even as it was besieged by its country, but it was hard. And I read that and I thought, you know, if a lot of us who are fathers have to be reflective in different ways for our own backgrounds, but I found that very, very moving. And it was hopeful that that he was able to do that, given a lot of the other things he describes in the book.
Yeah. I'm not going to argue with that. Loving your kid and trying to not replicate in the kid's life scars of your own, you know, from your childhood and such. This is a good thing. Ta-Nehisi Coates or anybody else.
Yeah.
And yes, there are many moving passages in the book, and the writing is of, you know, more than just passingly acceptable quality. It's well written, if not Baldwin-esque. I actually, on this point about physical violence and about hardness, found interesting, and I think worth discussing, the nature of the argument that Coates is making, this besieged environment that he talks about, besieged, of course, by white America, by white supremacy, and by whiteness, you know.
Yeah.
Ultimately the source, that's the prime mover of these dynamics. Parents are harsh with their children because they don't want their children to be overtaken by the harsh, presumed harshness of a world into which those children will be entering. And that harshness is not only or even mainly gangbangers on that block. That harshness is a white police officer who's not going to take back talk for an answer. That harshness is an employer looking for an excuse to give you the boot.
Yeah.
And that harshness is a cold, cruel, indifferent world, which if you think this dream about America being a land of prosperity and open opportunity is true for you, you got another thing coming and you better harden your attitude right now. The world hates you. It hates you because you're black. And I don't know that that's a good thing to be telling one's child. I'm trying to turn the table on you here a little bit, Errol Pollack. I don't want my kid to grow up being a gangbanger because I had to grow up being a gangbanger. But do I want my kid to grow up being so pessimistic about the possibilities of America when it takes an exaggeration of the reading of the social facts to come to some of the conclusions that I think Ta-Nehisi Coates has come to in this book? The American dream is a fraud. Try telling that to all the immigrants who are knocking on our doors trying to get in here. As a black American, people who are who mistakenly need to believe that they are white. Well, who's the race obsessed person in the room here? People walking around thinking about whiteness all the time, or black people like Mr. Coates walking around thinking about what they think white people are thinking about their blackness all the time. I don't find that white Americans are obsessed or invested in the concept of whiteness or need a fantasy in order to cover up the ugly reality of their country. That seems a hyperbole to me. I think I've talked long enough in this vein, but you see what I'm getting at.
Well, I mean, I have a more optimistic view than Ta-Nehisi does about some of these questions. And by the way, on the Baldwin thing, two things. By the way, Ta-Nehisi was not a gangbanger in any way. He just had the need to be walking around looking tough so that other people wouldn't mess with him, which is a different thing. But I think that there's this effort. I think that, you know, that this book has this quote from Toni Morrison that basically that Ta-Nehisi is this generation's Baldwin. And of course, as Ta-Nehisi himself has said, you know, Baldwin is this generation's Baldwin. I think this effort to rank people in the pantheon is so fundamentally boring, in the sense that we have a text on the table and we can have a really interesting conversation about the text. And is he over optimistic? You know, is he too pessimistic about race versus non? And then there's, who is America's outstanding public intellectual? And, you know, is Henry Louis Gates and Cornel West been knocked down off their pedestal, whatever? That is such a fundamentally useless conversation that is, to me, that's sort of the Superman versus Batman level of intellectual discourse.
Where, so why do you think we encounter it so frequently? Why do you think people talk like that?
That's a good question. I think that there's an effort to put African-American intellectuals into a box that we can understand. There's an effort to understand who can I turn to get a sense of the black experience as the... And I think that's just a fundamentally misguided thing. And partly it's our celebrity culture. You know, our celebrity culture goes to everything. You know, so Richard Feynman is the greatest physicist since Einstein or whatever. And that's not the way the collaborative intellectual enterprise works in any field. And from the inside, if I said to you, let's try to identify who is the outstanding economist in America, I think we would start to talk about that and we would say, wow, there's some people that we really admire. But it's fundamentally stupid to compare Paul Milgram to Paul Krugman about who is the greater economist, because they're really, first of all, they're not doing the same thing. And secondly, what's the point of that? You know, there's just a ton of people who are contributing in different ways to human understanding. And, you know, it's the limited attention span of the public. It's the attention economy rather than the intellectual enterprise that's generating this desire to, you know, to anoint particular people or to knock down particular people.
I get that. I think in the case of African Americans, some of this tendency may be the legacy of a history of, you know, the first black to do this and finally a black is doing that.
Yeah.
Whether it's getting the PhD from Harvard, I think W.E.B. Du Bois was the first African American to receive a PhD from Harvard. I believe I've heard that. And they were still saying it when I was appointed. They were still using this first kind of talk when I was appointed a tenured professor of economics at Harvard, because I believe I was the first African American to be appointed a tenured. You know, we're going to work our way down from W.E.B. Du Bois to Glenn Lowry. But the first black is still, you know, has some kind of cachet.
Well, Glenn Lowry had some, you know, Glenn Lowry did some good stuff.
And, I'd like to think so. Yeah. Okay. But enough about that.
Yeah. You know, certainly a well-earned tenure, whether it was the first of whatever. But I'd love for people to say, this is the first guy who got tenure in Harvard who wrote that really fascinating discussion of intergenerational transmission of inequality.
Yeah, actually, they read the paper in Econometrica and so forth. That would be great. Exactly. Yeah. That would be great.
Yeah.
But back to Colts and Baldwin, because I actually I had a long drive from the Outer Banks of North Carolina, where I was vacationing with my family, and coming back up to New England.
Mm-hmm.
And I listened to an audio book of Between the World and Me that was narrated by Ta-Nehisi himself, which was quite interesting. So, for example, he uses the verbal construction police, you know, which is the way you would say. I mean, his diction and his elocution is absolutely impeccable of the English language, except when it gets to the pronouncing of that word that rings in my mind. I say, my brother's got a point here. I know what he's saying. I know what he's doing here about the police. You know, he's talking to me. I can hear him, you know. Mm-hmm. And stuff. And I also listened to The Fire Next Time, an audiobook, you know, James Baldwin.
Oh, I've got to do that. That must be a wonderful
experience. It's very much worth doing. I mean, I don't know the name of the gentleman who narrates it, but he's absolutely fabulous at speaking this book. There are a lot of similarities I found between the two, not so much the literary style, but the world has beat us down. We've internalized that beating and we replicate it with ourselves. This is one of Baldwin's points that comes through very vividly. The assault on the conception of whiteness and race and the extent to which it operates in the service of people who are privileged, who seek to justify the prizing by whites of their innocence. They're seeking to be absolved of the responsibility for what history of slavery and the Jim Crow mistreatment of African Americans has wrought, looking to every corner for an excuse for it other than their own moral culpability. These are themes that I find in both works. So I'm not surprised that someone like Toni Morrison might have mentioned Baldwin in the same breath as commenting on Ta-Nehisi's books. Although, you know, it is, as he himself would say and has said to me, you know, I'm no James Baldwin. I never said I was any James Baldwin. Like you say, James Baldwin is James Baldwin.
Yeah. It's, by the way, I do think, of course, when you put those two books side by side, the differences in the two societies in which the books were written is so profound. And Ta-Nehisi actually alludes to that, where he talks about the incredible diversity of New York City that he is experiencing. That, you know, I mean, this is the reality that there are more Latino Americans than there are African Americans. And clearly, you know, that is the country is a fundamentally less white place in 2015 fundamentally less white place, fundamentally less white black place than it was in 1963. And I don't think anyone exactly knows the implications of where this is going. But it's not just that, you know, I mean, one argument is, well, we now have a black president. And so, and, you know, there's a certain naivete where you could say, well, we've ended our race problem because we've elected a black president. And that's obviously stupid. But there's this idea that our society is a more fluid thing in a way that no one quite understands where it's going. But the America of 2050 is one that, you know, that really will be the locus of political power, economic power, social authority is going to be much less with people who sort of self-identify as white in an obvious way. And I don't think, I don't quite know where that leaves blackness, but it's, we're going to be in a, we're in a different place.
Well, we're certainly in a different place, and we're in a better place. And we're not just in a different place. Yeah. And this is one of the things that, that annoys me about the Manichaean outlook that this book, Ta-Nehisi Coates' book, Between the World and Me, projects. Baldwin, in 1961, predicts, basically, that white America is going to run aground. Okay, he thinks that the emergence of the newly independent countries in the what would have been called then the Third World in the Global South, in Africa and Asia, is a harbinger of the beginning of the end of white global hegemony. He thinks, Baldwin does, that the society is so spiritually corrupt, doesn't know how to love, doesn't know how to be honest with itself about what, and this is part of what, from my reading, gives such enormous power to the literary expression in that book of Baldwin's, that it's going to run aground. He credits, at least seems to, the demands of the black Muslims. You know, it was a visit to the headquarters of Elijah Muhammad, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, head of the black Muslim sect in Chicago, that occasioned the writing of this essay in the New Yorker, at least seems to have been the point of it. After a long, you know, buildup, he sits down and comes down to cases about what the black Muslim upsurge means.
Yeah.
And he, you know, five states for black people in the South, you know, a complete divorce from black society. It would not be Baldwin's view, but he credits it as not entirely crazy. And he thinks it's a harbinger of something. Well, he was completely wrong, it seems to me, about all of that. He was completely wrong about the essential corruptness and unviability of, quote, white civilization. Quite the contrary, 10 years later, the civil rights movement had played itself out in institutional transformation. True, the war on poverty had been put forward as a sort of framework of, you know, law and policy to try to address not just race, but poverty more broadly. Now, you know, we could talk about it's worked out. Yes, the cities still have no-go zones and the quality of the lives of some people in our society, and too many of them are black, but not all of them are. Mm-hmm. This would be another bone I'd pick with Ta-Nehisi Coates. But the quality of lives of people are less than what we would want. But on the whole, I think one has to say that the pessimism and the kind of nihilism about America that was being expressed in Baldwin's early 1960s essay was not borne out by the facts. Likewise, I want to ask, well, whether or not going forward, I mean, let me give you just one concrete example, mass incarceration. I'm against it. I've been against it for years. I'm on the record being against it. It's one of the points where the Black Lives Matter people will, you know, launch a demand for reform. It's one of the areas in which Ta-Nehisi Coates would point as an evidence of this oppressive society. It hates black people and shows it. The black body fears it, hates it, wants to suppress it, wants to destroy it, and so forth and so on. But, and who knows exactly how this is going to work out. We're watching change happen before our eyes in this area. The country is actually bringing this issue forward in a bipartisan way. And there are a dozen different fronts on which practices that had been entrenched are, in relation to mass incarceration are being examined. Mm-hmm. I don't have to tell you because you're a liberal incrementalist reformer, at least you were last time I checked.
I am.
Reform is possible, and we have plenty of historical precedent about it happening. So this view that, you know, the fundamental corruptness and evilness, you know, plunder. The country is built on plunder. This is yet another, in my view, ahistorical and really silly idea. America is built on the backs of its slaves. Yes, slaves were exploited. America built on the backs of slaves? No economic historian is going to be able to make any sense out of that.
Well, it seems to me you're...
Et cetera. So,
I don't mean to cut you off.
No, I can come back with more thought.
There, I mean, it seems to me that what he identifies are real segments of American history and the American narrative, and it's as wrong to look away from those as it is to say that those are the exclusive elements of the American history and narrative. But, you know, they're clearly, they are important elements of it. And I mean, one thing, by the way, that's just to segue over to the Black Lives Matter issue. If one reads An American Dilemma, you know, written by someone, an outsider, 1944, Gunnar Myrdal writes this with the assistance of Franklin Frazier and a lot of other...
Ralph Bunche.
Yeah, Ralph Bunche, that's right. One of the things that Myrdal talked about is this twin issue in policing, where on the one hand, there's an incredibly high level of police brutality and enforcement of segregation. And on the other hand, there's an incredibly ineffective and deliberately so ineffective enforcement of public safety within African-American communities and the constant complaint that's coming. You know, we need law enforcement that is not brutalizing us, but that is actually working and that actually protects people from the crime that is a problem. And one of the things that struck me about one of the fundamental debates about Black Lives Matter, how do we square the grievances against the police with the need for a positive public safety agenda, is something that has always been part of that conversation. From the moment that conversation started, that those two things are actually kind of linked in, the same forces that allow officers to be brutal with impunity also allow officers to just be passive and inoperative with impunity. When you sent me a video about Black Lives Matter that reminded me of those passages from An American Dilemma. I mean, I don't know if you wanted to shift into a discussion of that, whether we're ready for that transition yet in the conversation.
We can do that. I mean, and we can come back to Between the World and Me as we go along, if that seems appropriate. Mm-hmm. The video that I sent you, I can't name this woman now, although she posted something that went viral. It's a tirade in which attacking the Black Lives Matter movement for not talking about the things that really matter. For her, the things that really mattered are public safety in communities with high crime rates where people are being victimized. Mm-hmm. And she feels that, I don't want to put words in her mouth, but I don't think this is untrue to the spirit of her tirade, that the Black Lives Matter movement, by seizing upon examples in which the police may have behaved inappropriately, may not have behaved inappropriately, sometimes it's not arguable that they behaved inappropriately, like shooting that guy in the back in South Carolina. Sometimes it is arguable about whether they behaved inappropriately, like the shooting of Michael Brown on that street in Ferguson, Missouri. But whether arguable or not, she's saying, look, you're siding with the thugs, quote unquote. You're siding with the bad actors, the ones who are making our lives miserable, the ones who walk around strutting around in our community, carrying guns, violating people, robbing and so on. And that's not what I want to be proud of about my community. I'm not proud of the kid who's undisciplined and who goes out and thinks that he can, you know, loot a store, or the kid who's in a gang and, you know, one color different from the other color and they end up shooting guns at each other and so forth. That's not something to be proud of. That's something I'm ashamed of. Why is it that you're lining up with those folks and not lining up, quote, with the decent people, so forth and so on? Now, this may not be at all fair to Black Lives Matter, but certainly that's that lady's perception. So, yes, part of it is a dualism between cops as the instruments of public safety in the community and cops as the purveyors of violence against the residents of the community. And that line, you know, the opposition between those two. We need the police to keep us safe, but we don't need the police to treat us with disrespect or abuse or be unaccountable for their taking of our lives in the extreme case. Mm-hmm. That's part of it. But part of it, I think, also is what phase do we want to put forward as we try to petition our fellow citizens for an enhancement of our rights? Do we want to be in the position of, you know, oh, I don't believe the cops. So Sandra Bland is dead after an arrest and having been put into a jail, and she is said to have taken her own life. Tragic. The interaction between her and the police officer that led to her arrest is recorded, and the police officer apparently stops her for a relatively flimsy reason and then takes exception because she's not yes sir, no sir when he comes up to talk to her. One thing leads to another. The situation isn't handled well. She's arrested and she goes into this jail cell, and then she's pronounced dead. Asphyxiation. A medical examiner concludes that it's suicide. What am I supposed to believe about that? Am I supposed to say to myself, oh, you know, the cops are lying yet again? Or am I supposed to say to myself, well, I can't imagine that duly constituted authority would murder somebody in a jail cell for the pure act of talking back to a cop and then try to cover it up? My gut instinct is the latter. I have to confess that. My gut instinct is to trust the institutions of authority in the society, even in this case, rather than to repair to this position of suspicion and almost conspiracy theoretic kind of about the integrity of the institution.
Isn't there a more, I mean, in that particular case, it seems to me that that officer, I mean, she basically was, she was incarcerated, she was locked up because she committed contempt of cop.
Contempt of cop, right.
And she was a person, and when you treat someone in that way, and you pull this person into jail, whatever vulnerability she might have had, I'm 90% certain that she committed suicide. I've always, and in fact, I think it's a real mistake to jump to the conspiracy theory as opposed to, you know, as the policy analytic person in criminal justice, my attitude is this person never needed to be locked up. She was locked up in a situation where the risk of suicide was clearly present at the at the population level. There's clearly a risk of suicide in the jail. She was not protected from that risk, and she shouldn't have even been locked up. And
I agree with that.
And it is, one can be completely outraged without. I think the murder conspiracy aspect of it actually detracts from what people should be outraged about, which was that. She should have been stopped in a professional way by that officer. She should have been treated in a professional way, which includes protections. I saw a picture of the inside of that jail cell, and there's a clear suicide risk in that. And you know, I was just in the Cook County Jail. I did as you know with Phil Cook and others. I was the led a study where I spent a lot of time in the Cook County Jail. And there's a very large number of people in the jail setting who've just had something very traumatic happen to them and who have various kinds of mental health vulnerabilities. And protecting people from self-injury is basically page one of the playbook. And to me, they are quite culpable from beginning to end of that episode for what happened to that woman. And and it's a distraction to argue that she had been murdered from my perspective, given what I know about the evidence, is a distraction to start going down that road.
But that's where a lot of people go with this, Harold. I mean, I was watching Meet the Press a couple of weeks ago when the woman who runs Demos,
mm-hmm.
I can't recall her name now, mm-hmm. an African-American woman, very well-spoken and intelligent person, mm-hmm. by all appearances, referred to Michael Brown's death as murder. She says something about, quote, the murder of Michael Brown. And I saw eyebrows raised by two or three of the other people who were on camera at the moment that she said that. But nobody circled back to say, why are we using that kind of language to talk about this evening? It's as if two independent investigations of the circumstances of Michael Brown's death hadn't concluded that the officer was not appropriately to be charged with any other offense. Yeah. So it enters into the consciousness as murder. You know, he was murdered. What is Ta-Nehisi Coates' son and Michael Brown's death figures in this book? The son has trouble sleeping at night or Some to the Sun on the night where the verdict was announced that Darren Wilson would not be indicted is so disillusioned about his America. This is the point that I was trying to make by reference to Sandra Bland. Do I really come away from a grand jury investigation that fails to indict with the conclusion that Michael Brown didn't get justice? Is my definition of justice that his murder must be avenged? This is a hyperbolic language. Well, and it's, I'll stop.
By the way, two things about, I mean, Ta-Nehisi in particular about this. One is Ta-Nehisi wrote a very good column after the two Justice Department reports came out, where he basically said, Darren Wilson, the officer who killed Michael Brown, may have been the only person in Ferguson to have gotten a fair investigation of what happened. And Ta-Nehisi basically says, this officer, there's substantial evidence that exonerates the officer and what happened. And he actually says in the book, he basically says assaulting an officer should not be a capital crime. He doesn't completely exonerate the officer in his own mind, but he basically says, you know, the incident, the details of this incident are substantially exculpatory to the officer. And even though the Ferguson Police Department as an organization seems to be highly predatory and deserves no benefit of the doubt, that he admired that the Justice Department did a serious investigation and basically came out with a lot of evidence that supported the officers, at least the account of the initial confrontation between the two men. And so...
It wasn't a capital crime. He says it shouldn't be a capital crime. He wasn't executed. He was not executed for assaulting an officer.
If I have talked to a lot of undercover police about what they thought happened in the Michael Brown case, and they basically all said what the Justice Department ultimately said they think happened. Now Michael Brown had a lot of bullets in him. I do not believe, I think most of the people who spend a lot of time arresting people don't believe that situation was properly handled, but they believe that they understand. They believe that Michael Brown was the initial aggressor, and that punished. But
better police work could have avoided this tragedy is one thing.
Yeah.
Murdered or executed for the crime of assaulting a police officer is another.
What many of the people that I talk to believe is that the officer was initially caught by surprise and was in a very frightening situation, that there was an element of panic that led to the number of times Michael Brown was shot and to a number of the ways that but let me just jump back though to two points. One is, I think you have a very good point that there's a need for greater restraint and particularity about different incidents. And I think that when I look at the Black Lives Matter, the constellation of causes and arguments around Black Lives Matter, I think there's a lot of positive mixed in with a need to augment with what they're doing. I think where I see some more positive than maybe you do or some other people might is when I went to a rally against violence in Lawndale, the Lawndale community in Chicago, by the old Sears Roebuck headquarters, and on the west side. And a lot of the people that were marching against gang violence and gun violence in their community are exactly the same people who are marching in the Black Lives Matter demonstrations and who are protesting against police violence. And there is tremendous activity on the ground by a lot of the same people that's trying to reduce the violence within the community as there is, that's just as important and just as visible in the community as the protests against police violence. And the same people who are saying we got to put all the guns down and everything are also saying no justice, no peace, and they're protesting against police, this and that. People see those two things as connected. And a lot of the people that I work with in violence prevention are the people out there talking to the gangbangers, trying to say, hey, you gotta put down your guns. We've got to find different ways to be in this community. They are also people saying the police have to change what they do. And it's not as if people who live in these communities who are upset about the police are somehow unaware of all the violence going on around them, you know, that might be labeled black on black crime or whatever. There's, you know, there's tremendous activity that's trying to do something about that.
Sure, of course.
And go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I would like to see the Black Lives Matter folks present a more positive vision of what good policing is and what effective public safety is, because I think that just explaining what we don't like about bad policing is not going to get the job done. Right now in Baltimore, what we're seeing is the police, part of the police response in Baltimore is to say, okay, you don't like what we do? Tell you what, we just won't do anything. We'll answer service calls and we'll just step back. And the result has been catastrophic.
Indeed. To black life.
Yes, absolutely.
Let me, before we go on, because I want to hear from you about what you think a positive agenda in terms of urban policing would look like. But I just want to talk about Bernie Sanders, and not only that, about the idea that if I say all lives matter in response to Black Lives Matter, the retort will be, you just don't get it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Especially if I'm a white politician and I say all lives matter. And I'm annoyed by that, Harold. I'm going to be perfectly honest with you. The annoyance comes from the sense that we live in a democracy and we actually need to persuade our fellows that that we stand for are valid and right and should be universally embraced. Of course, no one can argue with the idea that all lives matter. The complaint is that by saying that, you're trying to detract away from the racial dimension of the problem. But I want to say, I'm not so sure that the racial dimension of the problem is the most important thing about the problem. I want to say particularly that if we start talking about white police officers and what they do to black defendants, we may soon find ourselves in a world where people are talking about assailants and what they do to white victims. That there's a reason why newspapers have the protocol, if there's a crime that they're reporting on, of not reflexively and automatically calling attention to the racial identity of the person who is involved in the crime. They may run a picture and then we can infer from the picture that the person was black or whatnot, but they don't have lead editorials or lead headlines on their articles saying black thug or black murderer or black assailant or whatever, whatever. And yet reflexively, we seem to be wanting to talk about these relatively few incidents of police violence against citizens in racial terms. Now, let me just try to pull all of this together. It seems to me that the fundamental axiom has to be all lives matter, including black lives mattering, that to the extent that race is an issue and racial discrimination is an issue, it needs to be brought to the fore. But the presumption that a police officer who has a racial motivation in his interaction with someone who happens to black should be discounted unless there's evidence to support that presumption. Likewise, the presumption that a person who happens to be committing a crime, and many black people commit crimes in this country, and they commit them against white people as well as against black people, the presumption that the race of that person who offends is relevant to an assessment of the crime should be and is in most practice discounted. And so I'm worried about the salience that's given to racial identity as the beginning and the end of an argument about justice for Michael Brown. Justice for Michael Brown because a white police officer took his life. There's something that strikes me as it's not robust. It's not a kind of rhetoric that's only going to be able to win the argument in a broad enough way to change the institutions and the allocations of resources and the laws that Hillary Clinton was talking about in her with the Black Lives Matter people.
You know, I certainly agree with you that all lives matter and that the messaging of and that an inclusive message is going to reach the entire society in a way that's more likely to be successful than a narrower message. And there is, I think, you know, Bernie Sanders actually cares what the Black Lives Matter demonstrators think of him. If they show up and try to grab the microphone from several of the Republican candidates, you know, the security would kick them out and they would tell them fuck off and the audience would cheer. And, you know, black votes don't matter in the Republican primary. So the Black Lives Matter demonstrators don't matter a whole lot in that, except as the stage extras, at least until you get to the general.
Right.
I do think, though, that when you mention the Michael Brown case, the thing that the Black Lives Matter demonstrators rightly point out if you look at the other Justice Department report, where it describes the behavior of that police department, there is the behavior with such impunity over many, many years towards low-income African-American people, criminals, non-criminals, mostly non-criminals, by the police department, which is certainly not unique to Ferguson, that, you know, where there really is a sense that Black lives don't matter in the way that that the officers, white or black, in Ferguson case, almost all white, the way that officers are basically allowed to behave in a way that they would not be allowed to behave in other communities. And I mean, it is reading that that Justice Department report about the Ferguson Police Department, where every person, you know, bitten within a long period of time by a police dog is African American, and where a guy who is just playing basketball and is resting in his car ends up being hassled by the police and loses his job because of, you know, the overstepping of the police department and the revenue maximization and all this kind of stuff. There was a level of mistreatment that was racialized in some of its elements that has to be confronted. And Black Lives Matter is not, you know, that's their slogan, not mine. But they have certainly identified a set of specific things that need to be changed, that you know, that where you can't completely get away from the racial politics.
Well, you can't get away from it, but I don't think you should make it the centerpiece of your movement, the mm-hmm. racial dimension. I mean, I'm going to try to argue indirectly to that effect.
Okay.
States raising monies by gambling, by state-sanctioned gambling, state-approved casinos, state-run lotteries.
Yeah.
This is plunder, in my humble opinion.
It's hurting poor people in a predictable way.
This is supporting the middle class, most of which is going to be white,
yeah,
by a regressive taxation on the hopelessness and desperation of the poor. They're selling hope for profit in order to avoid going to the people who can actually afford to pay for the roads and the schools and the sewage and the police. Instead of going and raising the tax monies from the people who can afford to pay,
yeah,
they're basically plundering poor people.
By the way, a reference to the great book, Selling Hope. You may continue.
I'm aware of that book.
Yes.
So now, I'm sure that blacks are disproportionately overly represented amongst the set of people who are paying this tax on mm-hmm. hopelessness that mm-hmm. that the government is running. And I could imagine one approaching that question through the lens of the exploitation of black people using a statistical disparity in the extent to which those revenues are being raised from black people. But it seems to me that would just be, it would be a mistake politically, and it would also be a mistake conceptually. Conceptually, it would be a mistake because the presumption that the government is doing this to black people is wrong or in need of evidence that there's a kind of intent or intentionality about it. But it would be wrong politically because if I actually want to get people rethinking the structure of public finance, I want to talk about how we're all in this together and how that's not the kind of country we are, which is a claim about us Americans, us black and white Americans. Yeah.
I don't find that. I agree with you about that particular example. And I remember, by the way, you often see special interests trying to use racial politics. And in Washington, D.C., the bottling industry was trying to defeat a recycling initiative. And they basically ran a bunch of ads saying that the, you know, requiring a deposit on bottles was, they tried to racialize the politics of that in a way that was comical. I think that what your analogy misses, though, is there really is, there's a racialized conception of crime in America that's a real thing, that we, as a society, the link between black skin and criminality does go pretty deep. And, you know, we don't think of the lottery as a racialized issue, but we do think of crime as a racialized issue, and the fear of African American criminals and their use as a political prop and trope is a big part of our history. And so I think it's, you know, that is a big thread that runs through American racial politics, and that we can't completely discount. And, you know, police hassling of, you know, African American youth, is a big part of the everyday reality of millions of people. And and every young person that I talk to in Chicago, or I'm sure in any other city, would tell you, that it's affected them. And so I think it doesn't quite carry over to the lottery in the way that.
No, it doesn't. But it's I think more complicated too, and maybe more interesting than just described. Of course, there is this association, and there is the implicit bias that goes along with it of race with criminality. My friend Khalil Muhammad's profound book, The Condemnation of Blackness, which studies race and crime and punishment in the decades between 1890 and 1930, and contrast the way in which problems of social disruption and crime among Blacks were handled so differently than amongst lower class white European immigrant populations. The Condemnation of Blackness nails it, I think, and has a lot to say about the political and the intellectual origins and the institutionalization of this sort of racial bias and anti-Black stigma.
Yeah.
Of course, it has to be observed that there's also a significant racial disparity in the participation in criminal offending, especially in violent crime. And it's very, very hard not notice that or to ask people to disattend that, though I don't think it's, a bad thing to ask people to try to be aware of the subterranean racial bias that they imbibe just by being around in an environment in which there may be disproportionately high rates of offending. You can't avoid the evening news, but you don't have to let it run your life.
Yeah.
So the fact that most of the people in this population, that is Black people, will not be criminal offenders ought to be the first order fact in a person's mind, even though feelings of fear that they might get in certain circumstances are not unreasonable given the things that happen in those circumstances. It's the management of those feelings, it seems to me, that one has to worry about. But I think that's what I want to say about that.
Well, there's no question. One of the points that Ta-Nehisi makes, and that I think a lot of people have made that I think is right, is we have many levers to deal with, say, youth violence. And for much of the, throughout the society, the issue of socializing young men is a universal issue. And we have a lot of levers to do that. And among low-income kids of color, we deploy too few of the levers that of positive social development, and we rely too heavily on the levers of within the criminal justice system. And it is striking when I talk to people in Lawndale or Englewood or whatever, and they say, you see that abandoned house, nobody's doing anything about that. You see these kids that can't get jobs, nobody's doing anything about that. But boy, if one of those kids goes out and commits a crime, you are on that.
Including stealing copper out of that abandoned house. You know what I mean? Yeah. We won't build up housing, but if somebody goes in there and tries to make a living stripping the copper out of the thing, you're going to hunt them down because they're breaking and entering.
And I'll tell you, just linking you. So I think we need to have more stringent, swift, and certain penalties for young people who are caught carrying guns. I'm not a big believer in, I think there's a lot of people selling drugs. I don't think we should be hitting, we're too punitive in the drug domain. But we got all these young guys who are armed up because they're scared of each other. And we have to somehow change that cycle. And that means a real deterrent message around gun offenses. And it is a hard sell for me within a lot of these same communities to, when I go and I say that, people are like, you may well be right, but can you do something first to get that young person a job before you want to come back and talk to me about any kind of more punitive sanction? One of the things that's happened to police legitimacy is that the over-incarceration problem has really made it much harder for us to have a frank conversation about, well, here's some things we really do need to do to focus on the people who are killing people in this community. And because, you know, we really do have to focus on the gun carrying in a much more sustained way that really convinces that guy, you know what, and if you have a gun, it's a really good idea to keep it hidden behind grandma's house rather than carrying it with you so you end up shooting some guy who looks at your girlfriend, you know, when you get into it. We have lost the legitimacy of the criminal justice system within some of the communities that need it the most, you know, because of these larger policy failures. And that is really palpable in the work that I do. I mean, go ahead.
No, I was just going to echo a couple of things you're saying. You're talking about guns right now. I wanted to go back to say and agree with Coates to this extent. We have a multidimensional palette of policy avenues to respond to problems, including problems of public safety and criminal participation, education, jobs, housing, mental health, mm-hmm. health, income supports for families, mm-hmm. and so on. And we have many different degrees of intensity with which we can use the criminal justice system, the character of punishments and so on, like you say, swift and certain versus an uncertain but a very draconian system of punishment and so on. And I just want to say I agree with all of that, and I think those are important points. But I want to get back to this Bernie Sanders thing if I can.
Oh yes, I'm sorry.
Because there's something that just disturbs me about, not the particular, I'm not a Bernie Sanders devotee, it's okay, but I probably wouldn't vote for him. Just because I don't think he could win a general election. I don't know. We'll see. But I get that he's talking as a socialist about the structures that govern our economic and our political lives, about money and politics, about impunity on Wall Street and not just impunity at the station house, about the negative effects of trade on jobs. I'm not going to say I'm agreeing with Bernie Sanders about everything he wants, minimum wage through the roof. I'm not saying I agree with him about everything, but he's talking about the cause and effect dynamics of the economy and of the polity. That's where all the answers lie, it seems to me. And there's a seductive appeal when you've got the megaphone and you've got the moral high ground, as the Black Lives Matter people do to a certain extent. We'll see if they keep it. Okay, you have the incidents in Ferguson, Missouri, and in Charleston, South Carolina, and so forth. You got the high ground.
Cleveland, we can go down the list. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, you could go down the list. And there's, it seems to me, a necessity to convert that cachet, that leverage, into something that has a more powerful shadow that casts down over the future. And if it's not Bernie Sanders, then it would be somebody else. But somebody who is engaged with a debate about those structures. And so to kind of the race card, I don't mean that pejoratively. I mean it as a description. Mm-hmm. Just may be politically inept. And not because you're not winning a popularity contest. They will respond saying, we didn't come out here to make people mm-hmm. happy. We're not here to make white people feel good and so forth and so on. But what are you trying to accomplish? And how, you know, the steps between here to there, they're going to get accomplished. And what's your broader framework? Not just a racial critique, slavery, Jim Crow, white supremacy, but a systematic critique, a critique that acknowledges what globalization is doing in the world economy, that looks at the implications of vast unequal distributions of wealth and who has their levers on the hands of power. That maybe even goes to the point of saying every politician who opens his mouth and says, I'm for the middle class, has just written off a third of the country and mm-hmm. has indicated their unwillingness to do anything that the other two thirds don't like. That might be necessary to make life. Anyway, I stop. You see what I'm getting at.
Let me, I do, by the way, the particular incident I thought was, I was not a huge fan of what was done. First of all, it was boorish to go and grab a microphone from a 73-year-old man, you're basically counting on the fact that he and his supporters care enough about the African-American community that they won't just, you know, say, fuck off, have you arrested, and, you know, send you on your way. And they, and I think these particular people who did it, I don't think that, you know, that it's not clear who they represent and so on. So, if a bunch of people had gone and talked to Bernie Sanders privately and just said, you know, we want you to here's our issue agenda, and we want, you know, it would be nice if you included in your economic critique some of the race-specific issues that we are concerned about. My guess is Bernie Sanders would have said, you know what, I'm quite happy to do that. And there was a sort of showboating there. I also think that there's a need for a concrete agenda. And by the way, I thought one of the things that I really admired that some other people associated with Black Lives Matter did, called Campaign Zero, where they actually have a concrete policy agenda. They said, this is what we want to see to reform police practice. And they have this, which put them, when I compare them to the Occupy people, which I'm not an Occupy fan at all. I found Occupy to be exactly the negative example that the Black Lives Matter people need to be looking at, because that was this huge thing that ended up not being particularly constructive from my point of view.
Right.
Because they never really had a concrete ask, and because they gratuitously alienated a lot of people. And but when I look at this Campaign Zero, I look at a lot of the things that are there. For example, wanting police to have better training in de-escalation, and to use that as a frame for dealing with problematic behaviors by people on the street. There's a lot that can be done there that's concrete. Now, I'd like to see them go further than that and talk about what is it that we'd like to see police doing, what is it we'd like to see people who are not the police doing to prevent violence. But they really came out with something that was very positive and constructive. And my advice to policymakers would be, hey, look at this and find some things that you can agree with here that you think are feasible, and move them forward. That's light years ahead I think actually these demonstrators succeeded in their tactical goal of getting Bernie Sanders to talk about some things, getting themselves on the agenda, but only because they're in this political world among the people who are already basically their supporters and who don't want to be embarrassed by having distance from them. You know, the broader, I can't imagine Hillary Clinton would allow the same kind of episode to happen to her that Bernie Sanders had happened to him.
Well, my understanding is that there was the intent to disrupt her in New Hampshire by some Black Lives Matter activists from Massachusetts, but that the Secret Service preempted that.
Yeah, which I think is good, actually. We can't have a politics where a bunch of people, where thousands of people show up to listen to a candidate and a random group of people goes and disrupts it. You know, that is, by the way, I'm a big fan of the Moral Mondays movement, which is in North Carolina in particular. And that's where I, you know, if I'm going to donate my money to political cause, that's the one that I would donate to. The difference between a couple people grabbing the mic and 50,000 people showing up at the state capitol and saying, we want you to expand Medicaid and stop screwing with the voting law.
All the difference in the world.
And, you know, when I look, that is a group that really represents the African-American community of North Carolina and others, but principally the African-American community, in a very deep way. And you see these, you know, 55-year-old secretaries showing up to be handcuffed, and talking recipes with the police women who are locking them up and saying, we're appalled by the following three state policies. That to me is movement politics at a different order than showing up and disrupting something.
Okay. So let me push this point a little bit.
Okay.
During the 1 year anniversary commemoration of the shooting in Ferguson of Michael Brown, killing of Michael Brown.
Yeah.
Amongst the tactics that were employed by some demonstrators was an effort to shut down traffic on an interstate to St. Louis. I can't name the highway number. I was doing a little, let's call it research. We're going to be generous here. by reading the St. Louis Post-Dispatch reporting on these incidents, and then looking at some of the comments that came into the newspaper. Now, this is certainly not a systematic survey of anybody's opinion, but I was just stunned by the vitriol. You can dismiss these comments as racist, and some of them certainly gave evidence of having come from somebody who had racist views, but some of them were just exasperation and fury at the presumption that people's what they were demonstrating against was so important that they could go out onto an interstate highway, you know, ambulances trying to take people to the hospital, somebody's trying to get home from work after 12 hours, blah, blah, mm-hmm. blah, and shut down traffic. On the other hand, there's going to be a theory of, I don't know, protest politics that that kind of attention grabbing move is, you know, you're disrupting business as usual and so forth and so on. And I just wonder about that. I mean, I'm now trying to do a calculation of benefit and cost from the point of view of desiring progressive change of behaving in that way. There's a petulance there that and a kind of preciousness and kind of, as you say, a presumption that the authorities, and I wouldn't say the municipal authorities in St. Louis fall within this category of, are going to look the other way as you behave boorishly because they don't want to alienate your supporters or they basically have sympathy for your cause.
I wonder if it's, I don't know that you can give a general answer to, I think there really is a particularity to the calculation that has to be made. And, you know, for example, when I think about the Moral Mondays thing, so I have a friend who is a physician who works with stroke victims and she practices in a state that has not expanded Medicaid. And she describes to me what happens to the laborers who are uninsured, who have a stroke, and who end up in her hospital, and the way their lives are destroyed because the governor of her state will not take free federal money that would pay for the health care of these people. And the inhumanity of that, and the majority of people now in the United States who are shut out of the Medicaid expansion are African-American or Latino. And when I look at the inhumanity of that and the human consequences of that, and I think, would that justify blocking an interstate as part of a political action to protest that? I really have a hard time condemning people who would conclude, it. You know, some social disruption is important here. Given the magnitude of the indecent treatment that human beings are receiving. So, you know, there are times when, you know, protest isn't always pretty to see. It's not always well conceived, and it always should be subject to a strategic and moral critique. But sometimes the answer is, you know, yes, some social disruption is justified in order to generate movement on very, very real injustices that are being perpetrated on particular people. Now, to some extent, the proof is in the pudding. If you show up and you alienate everybody and you don't accomplish anything, then it might not have been a good idea. But would you, suppose someone had disrupted that same interstate in Missouri to try to help get the Voting Rights Act passed in 1965? I think we would all have said, you know what, that seems in historically, that seems pretty justified. And, if, you know, that we can't all, you know, so that's my reaction to that. You can't totally separate your justification of a particular tactic from your assessment of the cause that tactic is being used to advance and the skill with which you believe the organizers are pursuing that cause.
Okay, I think that's fair. And as I interrogate myself here now, why am I, you know, skeptical about that move? Why do I worry about that move? And it may be largely because it was not in the service of a very clearly defined objective politically. And it, when I use the word petulant, I mean tantrum throwing. I mean, you know, acting out. That's kind of what I have in mind because when I look to see what the, quote, demands are, end mass incarceration. I'm setting down traffic to, quote, end mass incarceration. You know, police murder, okay? I mean, again, as I say, some of these cases, it's not at all clear to me that's what is actually going on.
Seems like petulance also has there's an element of democratic legitimacy that you see as lacking that also is kind of behind the word petulance that, you know, if 100,000 people show up and sit on the road, they're not being petulant. They're expressing the sentiment of a community. When eight people show up and disrupt something, it's much easier to apply the word petulance because then you can say, well, who are you speaking for? And is there really, because at some level we do have a responsibility to not disrupt everything in society because of our own personal causes. And it's
Yeah, you're right. You're actually right. I mean, I can imagine, you know, there's a coup d'etat and we get people out in every city across the country in the tens upon tens of thousands and they won't go home and they're shutting down every friggin' thing. Or there's a general strike and, you know, now a lot of people are going to be inconvenienced, transit and public safety and other things that are not going to be available. But the stakes are just that fundamental. These are, you know, the straws of revolution in the air. Revolution against unjust and oppressive systems is a good thing historically, and it's not going to be pretty or convenient to the people who experience it. So a lot does depend on context and does depend on how much money I give to and how much legitimacy I think they are imbued with, those who are carrying out such acts.
By the way, it's interesting how historically, at any given moment, we may not see with clarity what the historical assessment will be. You know, for example, suppose somebody shut down that highway right now because of the evils of factory farming or because of the climate change. And in the moment, they may look like a bunch of eccentric nuts. And in fact, as individuals, they may be eccentric, because often eccentrics are the opening wedge of many social movements. It may be that 25 or 50 years later, people look back and say, wow, those people were really prescient. And, we now view, the idea that people were burning up the planet, or the idea that we had these cruel factory farms, social norms have shifted, and we now see those people as consonant with our current beliefs. So there's, in a sense, they're throwing a card down and saying, we think that people will see what we're doing and ultimately respond to it, or ultimately shift their beliefs.
Okay, Harold, we've been talking for a while. Maybe we can call it a day. There's a lot left to explore on this front. So, we should have another conversation sometime soon.
We should. Yeah. So,